Americans for the Arts.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up, we're going to talk about the governor's race and the race for U.S. Senate. We'll also be talking about possibly raising the sales tax twice in Hillsborough County. Those issues coming up in just a moment on Florida This Week. But first, four listener comments about last Friday's program. Last Friday, we were talking about the case of a woman from Pinellas County who was banned from Felipe Park because she peacefully objected to the spraying of a chemical called Roundup on the county park. The chemical has been identified by the World Health Organization as a likely carcinogen, a cancer causer. Here's what several listeners had to say following last Friday's show, in which we had a spokesperson for the Pinellas County Parks on.
What an awesome show. This is Rob from downtown St. Pete. You're bringing this out to light. Tanya is my hero for doing this. I can't believe they're spraying this crap in the parks. It breaks my heart because it's killing the waters. It's killing so many things. I think she is awesome for doing this. Thank you for having the show, and you guys are the best.
Yes, thank you so much for holding the director of Pinellas County Parks accountable and basically forcing him to answer questions on the air about the use of poisons in our parks. He misstated, maybe because he doesn't know or maybe deliberately, the risks of using these poisons, how they're used, how frequently, and how much they're used. And he doesn't understand the latest independent research, not Monsanto-sponsored research, which is meant solely to give it the ability to continue to sell these poisons, but real research that shows that there is no safety in using these poisons. They harm bees and other pollinators. They harm amphibians. They harm humans. They harm the entire chain of living ecology.
This is Cheryl. I just heard the whole show with the cozy guy from the Pinellas County Park. Wow, unbelievable. I believe the people, you know, being trained probably are just trained how to fill the bottles up with the poison and how to aim the spray, and they probably make $7 an hour and probably wear no respirators or protective clothing. And I think the whole thing is deplorable with the runoff and the state of our waters these days. I think it's disgusting, absolutely horrific, and there should be some natural way, the torches, anything organic.
My name is Betty Taylor, and I'm calling regarding the chemicals that were being sprayed at Philippi Park today, and the woman, Tanya, who was considered being trespassing, and she was just objecting to the chemicals that were being sprayed, which are toxic and cause cancer. I have lived in Safety Harbor, where the park is, for over 30 years, and I'm furious. I'm chemically sensitive, and let alone people who are sensitive, but everybody now is subjected to getting cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, from this. And they're spraying it all over the county. Please stop them and don't forbid her from going back to the park. It's a public park, and she was just doing a good job for other people that weren't aware. She has every right to be there, and she's just protecting everybody.
You were talking about the Roundup. I was riding my bicycle in Oldsmar near the railroad tracks, and whatever they sprayed on the tracks, you could hardly breathe when you went near the tracks. I can't imagine it must be too pleasant for people living near the railroad tracks, but I think they're probably spraying Roundup on the sides of the track to keep the weeds down. I don't understand why they need to do that, but they're probably spraying Roundup by the freight tankerful of Roundup. That's my opinion. I have no idea if that's what they sprayed, but it was pretty bad smell, and like a really bad insecticide smell.
There you have some listener comments that came in after last Friday's program. While you're listening to Radioactivity on WMNF in Tampa. Next up, we're going to hear Florida This Week from this past Friday night, which is a panel discussion on public TV about state and local politics. And I'm the host. It airs at 8:30 on Friday nights on WEDU. Here's the audio from Florida This Week from this past Friday. Coming up next, the tickets are set for the governor's race. Hillsborough County voters will decide on two tax issues this November. Once again, there's a teacher shortage in the state, and a judge orders the governor to turn over his travel records. Political Insights next on Florida This Week.
WEDU Studios, this is Florida This Week. And now, moderator Rob Lori.
Welcome back. This week our panelists are Jessica Ehrlich is an attorney and a Democrat. Mark Proctor is a political consultant and a Republican. Claire McNeil is a reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. And Zach Anderson is the political editor for the Sarasota Herald Tribune. Well, it's great to have you here. Thank you for coming. Well, the two major party candidates for Florida governor have picked their running mates. Democrat Andrew Gillum has tapped Orlando area businessman Chris King, one of the people who Gillum defeated in the primary. King is a millionaire and a CEO of a housing company. He's a Christian who has never held public office, and he's pushed some very liberal ideas. King says Democrats need to use Bible teachings to persuade Republicans to support policies to help the poor, the sick, and the homeless. He favors legalization of marijuana. He criticized the sugar industry, called for a tax on ammunition to pay for school safety, and he would abolish the death penalty entirely. On the Republican side, Ron DeSantis chose State Representative Jeanette Nunes, who would become the state's first Cuban-American woman to be lieutenant governor if the Republican slate wins. There is some controversy, though. Nunes had tweeted during the 2016 presidential campaign that DeSantis' most prominent backer, Donald Trump, was a con man who supported the Ku Klux Klan. Nunes and DeSantis say that was in the past and it's time to look forward. And while DeSantis has a tough on immigration position in line with Trump's, Nunes was the prime sponsor of a 2014 education bill to provide in-state college tuition for undocumented immigrant children living in Florida. So, Mark, do Florida voters care who the lieutenant governor is?
Generally speaking, they don't. There have been a couple of articles this week by some of the journalists that say the lieutenant governor of Florida is a meaningless post. You get $125,000 a year for doing nothing. Historically, the lieutenant governor, actually, we didn't have a lieutenant governor for a number of years. They reinstituted back in 1968. And trivia, Ray Osborne was our first lieutenant governor under Claude Kirk.
You get extra points for
that. There you go. Yeah. And there have been two lieutenant governors that became governor. One was Wayne Nixon, who became governor for 3 days when Bob Graham resigned to run for the U.S. Senate. And the other one was Buddy McKay, who was less than 30 days. That's because Lawton Charles had died, you know, at the end of his term. So other than that, nobody really even runs on to run for governor or things like that. I don't think people really pay a lot of attention to it. But.
So do you think any of these candidates is a drag or a help?
I think let's go back to when Rick Scott picked Jennifer Carroll in Duval County. It was like, okay, she's the first African American woman on the ballot and things like that.
And then
I think Zach pointed out that he actually didn't do that well in Duval County. So what are they doing? And then you're right, they had a falling out. Now he's got the Carlos.
Right. Jessica, what do you think? Do either one of these selections help or hurt the ticket?
Well, certainly, I think from DeSantis's point of view, he was strategizing towards having a woman, having someone that he feels a kinship with, given both of their relationships with Marco Rubio, DeSantis, and with Nunez. And also he's trying to shore up the Hispanic vote in South Florida. Certainly the numbers that they're seeing so far show that he has a lead right now with Hispanic voters, with Republican voters, and with white male voters, especially those over the age of 65. And, you know, I think he feels like he has a strong enough hold in North Florida. He wants to have that edge sort of with someone in South Florida. Her first campaign appearances are all going to be in South Florida. She is bilingual. She can speak Spanish, obviously, and will be down there and, you know, going out and being his spokesperson in that sense. Whether that, you know, helps or hinders, I think it's sort of, you know, a situation with, you know, with Gillum where it's not as crucial. I mean, he wanted to have someone who is ideologically and personally has his back and that he feels a kinship with. And certainly, given the sort of bruising that happened during the primary, he and Chris really got along, you know, the best. Mm-hmm. And he's already sort of that person who's out there. I mean, he's the first African-American candidate that we've had for governor. So I think in that sense, you know, his voters are Democrats and they are a large proportion of the African-American community. He has those voters, and I think with both of them, it's going to be getting people to the polls.
Zach, both Gillum and his running mate King are very progressive. The Republicans are trying to tag that team with the socialist tag. How do you think that's going to play? I mean, I'm sure we're going to hear that word socialism tied to the Gillum campaign over and over again. How do you think that's going to play in this election?
Yeah, it was interesting. Right after Ron DeSantis was nominated, the first thing he did was try and go after Gillum as a socialist and really try and hammer that home. It was interesting. Today, I was in Sarasota and I interviewed Jeff Weaver, who is the was the campaign manager for Bernie Sanders in 2016. He's doing a book tour coming through Florida, and he stopped in Sarasota and I asked him about this. I was like, do you think this is an effective line of attack? And he sort of laughed it off and said, you know, they called Barack Obama a socialist. They called Hillary Clinton a socialist. They're going to call pretty much every Democrat a socialist. That's been one of the big lines of attacks for Republicans against Democrats in recent years. I don't think it resonates as much with, especially with younger voters, but some folks have pointed out this week that, especially in the Miami-Dade area, an area where you have a lot of people who might have come from Venezuela or Cuba, socialism doesn't have a very good image there, and that maybe he's trying to hit that home and try and influence some of those voters.
Could I add, Gallup recently did a poll that showed 57% of the Democrats are more inclined or at least favorably look towards socialism, while only 16% of the Republicans. But here's the key. We've had a Republican primary. We've had a Democratic primary. A third of the voters haven't really weighed in, and that's the undecideds or the independents or NPAs, whatever you want to call them. So the question is, where are they going to go in terms of this issue and other issues? So I think the election, in my opinion, is yet to come.
Well, anecdotally, also, I've heard from three white males over the age of 65 immediately following the primary who said to me in social settings, oh, well, isn't Andrew Gillum a socialist?
Mm-hmm. And they said that obviously in a negative way.
Yes. Yeah. And they were serious. Uh-huh. It was not like, oh, like it was a joke or something, whatever. I mean, they believe that he is a socialist.
Let me also bring out the other elephant in the room, and that is the fact that after this election, somebody called me and said, did you know that Andrew Gillum was under FBI investigation? I said, yeah, for about 2 years. I think it was baked into the cake. I don't think that was any earth-shattering news, but again, it's kind of like they already have it.
One interesting thing about Gillum is he actually is talking about raising taxes, which is unusual for a governor's candidate in Florida. He wants to raise the corporate income tax rate from 5.5% to 7.75%. We haven't really seen that in Florida. So the attack that they're trying to make, and maybe some people would think that it's over the top, but Andrew Gillum is much more progressive probably than any other candidate for governor that has been put on the ballot in Florida. And it'll be interesting to see if voters will go for that.
Claire, the issue of race also came up this week a second time in the last few days, and that is that a Nazi group used robocalls to attack and kind of mock Andrew Gillum's campaign for governor. What's your sense about, you know, how that's going to affect the race?
I think people from all parties pretty swiftly came out and condemned those calls. Governor Scott was among the first to very harshly condemn those acts. And so I do think that those comments will stick to DeSantis throughout the race. I don't know that he can really brush those aside, given how immediately people seized onto them as being pretty explicitly racist. But at the same time, I think the Gillum campaign is trying to, they didn't seem to want to amplify them. At least that was my sense.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too. I think DeSantis did come out and distance himself and said this is wrong.
And after the initial first day of the monkey, this up. I mean, yeah. The wolf whistle, whatever you want to call them, they're out there. This is a page that he's taken out of Trump's book, and I think we're going to continue to see it throughout the campaign. And it was successful in the last election, and it could be successful for him as well. So I don't know that he's actually really going to distance himself as much. I mean, when he's making the comments himself.
Okay. Well, there will be two tax increase proposals on this November's ballot in Hillsborough County.
One would raise the sales tax by a penny per dollar to pay for transportation improvements. The other would raise the sales tax by a half cent to better fund education. If both pass, it would make the sales taxes in Hillsborough County the highest in the state.
So, Jessica, these are really targeted. These are not broad brush taxes. There's an outline of where the money would go. What's your sense of where voters are at these days, whether it's Hillsborough County or any other county in the state? If it's a targeted tax increase, are they likely to go for it?
Well, what we've seen in general with Hillsborough County, which is sort of fascinating, there have been lots of articles on it recently, is that Hillsborough is becoming so much more metropolitan and more in line with some of the bluer counties that we see in South Florida or even around larger metropolitan areas like Jacksonville. So I think that given also that it was the one county also that went for Gillum in the primary, as opposed to Pinellas, which is more conservative, hopefully, especially given the high number of children and the transportation issues, as someone who tries to drive to Tampa from Pinellas County, I mean, it is just every day it gets different and worse. Mm-hmm. So the transportation and infrastructure issues, as this area continues to grow, as new development comes, as we try to attract more and more businesses, it just has to be there. At the same time, we have to have the education system for people that want to put their kids into it. We have one of the largest now in the state, in this Hillsborough County area, in terms of the number of students that they're servicing. The buildings are majority over 100 years old, and they are having issues that we've seen, we've talked about, whether it's with air conditioning, radon, lead paint. I mean, it's a very serious, kids can't learn if they can't be in an environment, and the teachers can't teach. That's the whole reason that they're there.
Mark, the transportation people and the education people in Hillsborough County, they're kind of allies, they're cousins, they have a lot of commonality, but the complaint from both sides is, why didn't we work this out? Because both of these coming up at the same time, raising the sales tax to the highest in the state, maybe Hillsborough County voters won't do both this November.
Well, my inclination would be to say that they won't do both. If they do one, I think the education is more likely to pass. I think that, and again, I can't read the minds of our school board members, but I think they wanted to get that education half cent on the ballot in case the transportation passed, so people would be less likely to vote for a second tax. But in Hillsborough County, they historically voted for taxes, but they had to be well defined. We had the ELAP program, which environmental land. We had the indigent health care plan, which took care of indigents, and of course the famous stadium tax. When it's presented properly, people in Hillsborough County will vote for it. Will they vote for two taxes that will increase the sales rate to 8.5%? Here's my prediction. The older population will probably vote that no. The younger population, so if they turn out, that could sway the election completely differently.
Zach, you've had some experience covering the tax issue in Sarasota. There have been a couple of tax increases targeted for education in both Sarasota and Manatee counties.
Yes, both Sarasota and Manatee have both passed property tax increases for education that went to help pay for teacher salaries and other things in the school district. Sarasota County also has a infrastructure sales tax that they have renewed over the years. And you use a good word, targeted. If these are targeted and you're able to really define for voters what these are, I think you can go out and make that pitch, and voters, at least in Sarasota and Manatee, and I think a lot of communities around the state, have been receptive to that. If they feel like this is going to improve the quality of life in their community.
All right, well, let's continue the conversation about education. The school year began just a few days ago for K through 12 students.
As in past years, there's a teacher shortage, but this year it's worse. A review of 3 years' worth of statewide teacher job vacancies reveals a disturbing trend. 2 years ago, the number of advertised teaching openings was about 2,400. Last year, the number rose to 3,000, and this year it's over 4,000. The shortages are most severe in the sciences, math, English, and reading. When it comes to teacher pay, Florida ranks near the bottom, 45th in the country.
So, Claire, you've covered education for the paper. Is it simply that we pay teachers so little here in Florida? That's why we're having a hard time finding teachers this year?
Teacher pay is absolutely a critical part of it, but having covered a handful of school board primaries so far this year, the culture goes so much deeper than that. The sense you get from teachers and people who are hoping to be elected is they say over and over again that the system is broken, that teachers are expected to do too much. They're given too little time to plan. They're buying supplies for the classroom out of their own pockets. The air conditioning is broken. The discipline systems don't work. They're being left alone in classrooms without adequate training in terms of dealing with kids who are struggling and acting out. And I think there's just a general beleaguered sense of being left alone.
This is a statewide problem. It's not just a one county. It's in every county in the state.
Yeah, absolutely. It spans the state. And one of the main things that you're seeing is a pipeline issue as well. So not only are teachers feeling worn down, but the mechanisms that we have to fill those jobs. The education schools at USF, for instance, enrollment in the College of Education is down 40-something percent.
Nobody wants to go into
people
teaching as a
professional. People don't want to be teachers these days.
Yeah.
And,
Let me also bring up an issue that maybe we forgot about, the supply and demand. And what I mean by that is the rule of unintended consequences. In 2002, we passed a state amendment limiting class size. So you've got a growing state, and you can only have 25 students in a classroom, which means once you get to 25, you got to start a new classroom, you got to build more rooms, you got to hire more teachers. So part of the problem is the fact that, you know, back in my day, we had 32 kids in the classroom. You know, we walked 20 miles to school,
and
it was an air conditioned. But the point is that now we've forced these schools to build more schools and to hire more teachers. So I think the bottom line is we need to pay them more.
Jessica, I hear Democrats saying, though, that we have consistently underfunded education for the last 20 years. What say you?
I think, actually, Andrew Gillum has a really great plan that he's put forth that we haven't heard from DeSantis on how he's going to address the situation. And clearly our ranking as a state has continued to fall in terms of our public education and what we're offering our children in our future. And his plan is basically putting, you know, almost $1 billion over the next 7 years into education and everything from additional training for people who want to go into vocations, not necessarily into college, increasing teacher salaries. Right now we are, I think, around the eighth lowest in the country in what we pay our teachers, and varying from county to county in the state of Florida, it is very expensive to live in most of this state. And if we're going to have teachers, firemen, police, I mean, it's the same for all of our, you know, people that we count on. We have to not only get up to speed in what we're paying them over time, make sure our pensions are there, and make sure that we are having kids who are wanting to go out of high school. There's a very interesting article I read about a program they have in Bartow where they're getting high school kids, if they start taking classes to become a teacher while they're still in high school, they can graduate early and with their AA degree and go directly into a program where 2 years after high school graduation they're able to teach, because they have such a problem in that county with getting teachers.
What about Mark's point? He thinks that the class size amendment has created this problem. What do you think?
No. Also because the class size, as you know, was already said, is not just the main issue here. They need to be smaller because the teachers are having a heck of a time keeping these kids, like, focused. They've got tests that they have to take all the time. They can't even teach to the children. If there's one kid that's having a problem or falling back, they don't have the time to spend with them. They don't have enough resources, and they don't have enough assistance and people. There are just aren't enough for the number of children. And also, we've seen an increase in our population and in our youth in this state that we didn't have in 2002. We now have more children that need education. More and more people are coming here on a daily basis, and we need to address that.
I just want to talk about the budget with regard to the class size amendment, that the state in the last 16 years has spent $37 billion, according to the state's website, for additional funding for the operational costs as a result of the class size amendment. So a lot of the money that should have gone to the teachers did go to these operational aspects.
Jessica's point, though, is that as society becomes more frayed, smaller class sizes are desirable.
I mean, I voted for it. I'm just saying it was one of those unintended consequences. I wanted a smaller class size, too.
Okay. And if we're going to be testing each child multiple times over and over and keeping that as our criteria, they have to have a smaller class size.
Yes, it's a constitutional amendment, so it's not going away. I'm just making a point.
All right. Well, Tallahassee judge is ordering Florida Governor Rick Scott to hand over copies of his travel schedule after the governor's office tried to contend that information is confidential.
The judge gave the Scott administration 10 days to produce copies of his schedule running from July 20 of this year until the end of next month. The information must include his campaign and fundraising schedule as well as anything related to his official duties. Scott is running for the U.S. Senate. A spokesperson for Scott said the governor would appeal the ruling, saying that to hand over the information would create a security risk for the governor. He added that the lawsuit was brought by a disgruntled vendor. That vendor, Positive Healthcare Florida, sued to make public Scott's schedule amid a contract dispute involving Florida's Medicaid program. The company is losing a state contract to provide services to people who are infected with HIV or AIDS.
So, Zach, a lot of reporters see the governor's schedule every day. If you were to tell our audience what the governor reveals about his schedule every day, what would they see when they look at the governor's schedule?
Well, for one thing, the schedule comes out very close to when, you know, these events are actually happening, which is a departure from precedent. Oftentimes, it's later in the evening that he sends out his schedule for the next day, or sometimes even in the morning of that day, and past governors have released their schedules earlier, and oftentimes there's big blank spots on these schedules where you really don't know what the governor is doing. It's kind of vague what he's doing. And the idea that this is a security threat for the governor if you release his schedule ahead of time, I mean, he can certainly make that argument, but I think you have to weigh that against the public's right to know. The public has a right to know what their governor is doing, who he's meeting with, who he's having lunch with, who he's on having phone calls with. And his office has sort of dismissed this as a sort of disgruntled vendor. Well, maybe they do have an agenda in trying to find out what the governor is doing, but their agenda might dovetail with the public agenda. You know, this is a vendor that lost this contract. What if they got records that showed that the governor weeks from now is having a fundraiser with the head of the company that got the contract? You know, that could raise questions about the bid process. So, and that's also an important thing that the public would want to know. So I think that in general, we want our officials to be transparent and accountable and to release as much information as possible. And we have these sunshine laws in Florida. These public records are supposed to be available.
Lucy Morgan, the longtime reporter and columnist for the Tampa Bay Times, before that the St. Pete Times, calls this governor the most secretive in history.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't been covering state government as long as Lucy Morgan or other people, but I know that the reporters that I talk to who have been covering the governor for a while and who have covered past administrations are frustrated with the amount of information that is provided and the response that they get sometimes when they have records requests.
Well, he's going to fight it, but he's got till September 15th to turn over the records, the judge says. Well, what other story should we be paying attention to? Mark, your other big story of the week.
Well, there was an article in the Tampa Tribune edition of the Tampa Bay Times about WeatherTight Windows is a local hurricane window company. And disclosure, I've ordered windows from them. They bought a piece of property to expand their parking lot at the facility. And when they went before the city council, Councilman Miranda said, oh, it's an election year, we can't vote for that, or words to that effect, kind of making a joke. They've now sued, saying, wait a minute, you took away our property rights for something he wanted to do because it's an election year. So I think this will be an interesting battle to see what happens there. Nobody can talk about it now because it's under litigation.
All right, Zach, your other big story?
Well, one story that I covered this week, Democratic candidate for the District 16 congressional seat, David Shapiro, came out and said that he would not support Nancy Pelosi for Speaker of the House if he was able to beat Congressman Vern Buchanan, who represents an area that includes Sarasota, Manatee, and part of Hillsborough County. Shapiro is one of three Democrats who are running for Congress in this area. The Tampa Bay Times reported that there's two other Democrats who have come out and said that they would not support Nancy Pelosi for Speaker either. It just shows how toxic she is in some quarters. She has a fairly low approval rating, and so this will be something to watch going forward. If more Democrats come out and take this pledge, what will happen?
All right. And Claire, you're on the big story?
I recently was up in Gainesville working on a story about black students at the University of Florida. So UF has had a banner year in terms of climbing up the ranks and breaking into the top 10 public universities in the country, which is a very big deal. And yet, the climate for black students on campus is not quite as rosy. Enrollment is down to 6%, which is a big departure from population averages across the state. And if you talk to these students over and over again, they'll tell you that they are just completely worn down by what they see as being isolated on campus, feeling alone in their classrooms, very few black faculty members. So UF has brought on its first chief diversity officer. And I think it'll be interesting to watch how they address this culture while also rising in the ranks.
That is a powerful story. I read it, and the alienation in there just jumps off the page. All right, and Jessica, another big story.
Well, there's so much going on, obviously, in D.C. and everything happening between the Kavanaugh hearings and what is going on between papers being released and not. But I think today was really fascinating because President Obama came out at the University of Illinois and did his first campaign trail speech. This is, you know, a very big deal for a past president to come out and mention Trump by name. He's going to be out going from state to state, campaign to campaign, because the focus right now on the national level is candidates like David Shapiro trying to take back the House and, more importantly, hold on to and increase the ability to take the Senate. And we saw Trump today. He was in Montana. He's in North Dakota and also going to Indiana, three key states for Democratic members of Congress who are moderate, who have to hold on to those Senate seats. And they've already started handing them with major, major amounts of money going from the Republican Party to ads in those states. So it's going to be, you know, a very interesting ride.
The battle is on.
Yes. Well,
thank you all for a great show.
Well, that was Florida This Week from this past Friday night. And my guests were, going backwards from the people we heard at the end, Jessica Ehrlich is an attorney in St. Petersburg. She was the Democrat on that panel. Mark Proctor is a local business person in the Brandon area. He was the Republican on that panel. Claire McNeil covers education for the Tampa Bay Times. She was one of the journalists. The other journalist was Zach Anderson, the political editor at the Sarasota Herald Tribune. And if you want to comment about anything you've heard here so far, you can email us in the studio here at dj@wmnf.org. Well, we heard Jessica Ehrlich mention President Obama's speech last Friday at Champaign-Urbana at the University of Illinois campus there. And as I was getting ready to tape Florida This Week, I kept getting texts from people talking about the speech. Over the years, we've played a lot of speeches by politicians. In the last few years, we've played speeches by President Trump and also Bernie Sanders. Quite a few speeches by both of them. Let's listen into a little bit of the speech by President Obama at the University of Illinois last Friday. This is a speech that's gotten a lot of attention, and I want to get your comments about this. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. You can also email your comment in at dj@wmnf.org. Let's pick up where President Obama talks about why he decided to come out and start making speeches again.
We need to hear from you, just a little something. The truth was, I was also intent on following a wise American tradition of ex-presidents gracefully exiting the political stage and making room for new voices and new ideas. And we have our first president, George Washington, to thank for setting that example. After he led the colonies to victory as General Washington, there were no constraints on him, really. He was practically a god to those who had followed him into battle. There was no constitution, there were no democratic norms that guided what he should or could do. And he could have made himself all powerful. He could have made himself potentially president for life. And instead, he resigned as commander in chief and moved back to his country estate. And 6 years later, he was elected president. But after two terms, he resigned again and rode off into the sunset. And the point Washington made, the point that is essential to American democracy, is that in a government of and by and for the people, there should be no permanent ruling class. They're only citizens who, through their elected and temporary representatives, determine our course and determine our character. I'm here today because this is one of those pivotal moments when every one of us, as citizens of the United States, need to determine just who it is that we are, just what it is that we stand for. And as a fellow citizen, not as an ex-president, but as a fellow citizen, I'm here to deliver a simple message, and that is that you need to vote because our democracy depends on it. Now, some of you may think I'm exaggerating when I say this November's elections are more important than any I can remember in my lifetime. I know politicians say that all the time. I have been guilty of saying it a few times, particularly when I was on the ballot. But just a glance at recent headlines should tell you that this moment really is different. The stakes really are higher. The consequences of any of us sitting on the sidelines are more dire. And it's not as if we haven't had big elections before or big choices to make in our history. The fact is, democracy has never been easy, and our founding fathers argued about everything. We waged a civil war. We overcame depression. We've lurched from eras of great progressive change to periods of retrenchment. Still, most Americans alive today, certainly the students who are here, have operated under some common assumptions about who we are and what we stand for. Out of the turmoil of the Industrial Revolution and the Great Depression, America adapted a new economy, a 20th century economy, guiding our free market with regulations to protect health and safety and fair competition, empowering workers with union movements, investing in science and infrastructure and educational institutions like U of I, strengthening our system of primary and secondary education, and stitching together a social safety net. And all of this led to unrivaled prosperity and the rise of a broad and deep middle class, in the sense that if you worked hard, you could climb the ladder of success. Now, not everyone was included in this prosperity. There was a lot more work to do. And so, in response to the stain of slavery and segregation and the reality of racial discrimination, the civil rights movement not only opened new doors for African Americans, but also opened up the floodgates of opportunity for women and Americans with disabilities, and LGBT Americans, others to make their own claims to full and equal citizenship. And although discrimination remained a pernicious force in our society and continues to this day, and although there are controversies about how to best ensure genuine equality of opportunity, there's been at least rough agreement among the overwhelming majority of Americans that our country is strongest when everybody's treated fairly. When people are judged on the merits and the content of their character, and not the color of their skin, or the way in which they worship God, or their last names. And that consensus then extended beyond our borders. And from the wreckage of World War II, we built a post-war web architecture, system of alliances and institutions to underwrite freedom and oppose Soviet totalitarianism and to help poorer countries develop. And American leadership across the globe wasn't perfect. We made mistakes. At times, we lost sight of our ideals. We had fierce arguments about Vietnam, and we had fierce arguments about Iraq. But thanks to our leadership, a bipartisan leadership, and the efforts of diplomats and Peace Corps volunteers, and most of all, thanks to the constant sacrifices of our men and women in uniform, we not only reduced the prospects of war between the world's great powers, we not only won the Cold War, we helped spread a commitment to certain values and principles, like the rule of law and human rights and democracy, and the notion of the inherent dignity and worth of every individual. And even those countries that didn't abide by those principles were still subject to shame and still had to at least give lip service to the idea. And that provided a lever to continually improve the prospects for people around the world. That's the story of America. A story of progress. Fitful progress, incomplete progress, but progress. And that progress wasn't achieved by just a handful of famous leaders making speeches. It was won because of countless quiet acts of heroism and dedication by citizens, by ordinary people, many of them not much older than you. It was won because rather than be bystanders to history, ordinary people fought and marched and mobilized and built and, yes, voted to make history. Of course, there's always been another darker aspect to America's story. Progress doesn't just move in a straight line. There's a reason why progress hasn't been easy, and why throughout our history, every two steps forward seems to sometimes produce one step back. Each time we painstakingly pull ourselves closer to our founding ideals, that all of us are created equal, endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, the ideals that say every child should have opportunity, and every man and woman in this country who's willing to work hard should be able to find a job and support a family and pursue their small piece of the American dream. Our ideals that say we have a collective responsibility to care for the sick and the infirm, and we have a responsibility to conserve the amazing bounty, the natural resources of this country and of this planet for future generations. Each time we've gotten closer to those ideals, somebody somewhere has pushed back. The status quo pushes back. Sometimes the backlash comes from people who are genuinely, if wrongly, fearful of change. More often, it's manufactured by the powerful and the privileged who want to keep us divided and keep us angry and keep us cynical because that helps them maintain the status quo and keep their power and keep their privilege. And you happen to be coming of age during one of those moments. It did not start with Donald Trump. He is a symptom, not the cause. He's just capitalizing on resentments that politicians have been fanning for years. A fear and anger that's rooted in our past, but it's also born out of the enormous upheavals that have taken place in your brief lifetimes. And by the way, it is brief. When I heard Amari was 11 when I got elected, and now he's like started a company. That was yesterday. But think about it. You've come of age in a smaller, more connected world where demographic shifts and the winds of change have scrambled not only traditional economic arrangements, but our social arrangements and our religious commitments and our civic institutions. Most of you don't remember a time before 9/11 when you didn't have to take off your shoes at an airport. Most of you don't remember a time when America wasn't at war, or when money and images and information could travel instantly around the globe, or when the climate wasn't changing faster than our efforts to address it. And this change has happened fast, faster than any time in human history. And it created a new economy that has unleashed incredible prosperity. But it's also upended people's lives in profound ways. For those with unique skills or access to technology and capital, a global market has meant unprecedented wealth. For those not so lucky, for the factory worker, or the office worker, or even middle managers, those same forces may have wiped out your job, or at least put you in no position to ask for a raise. And as wages slowed and inequality accelerated, those at the top of the economic pyramid have been able to influence government to skew things even more in their direction, cutting taxes on the wealthiest Americans, unwinding regulations and weakening worker protections, shrinking the safety net. So you have come of age during a time of growing inequality, a fracturing of economic opportunity. And that growing economic divide compounded other divisions in our country. regional, racial, religious, cultural. It made it harder to build consensus on issues. It made politicians less willing to compromise, which increased gridlock, which made people even more cynical about politics. And then the reckless behavior of financial elites triggered a massive financial crisis 10 years ago this week. A crisis that resulted in the worst recession in any of our lifetimes and caused years of hardship for the American people, for many of your parents, for many of your families. Most of you weren't old enough to fully focus on what was going on at the time. But when I came into office in 2009, we were losing 800,000 jobs a month. 800,000. Millions of people were losing their homes. Many were worried we were entering into a second Great Depression. So we worked hard to end that crisis, but also to break some of these longer-term trends. And the actions we took during that crisis returned the economy to healthy growth and initiated the longest streak of job creation on record. And we covered another 20 million Americans with health insurance, and we cut our deficits by more than half, partly by making sure that people like me, who've been given such amazing opportunities by this country, pay our fair share of taxes to help folks coming up behind them. And by the time I left office, household income was near its all-time high, and the uninsured rate had hit an all-time low, and wages were rising, and poverty rates were falling. I mention all this just so when you hear how great the economy is doing right now, let's just remember when this recovery started. I'm glad it's continued, but when you hear about this economic miracle that's been going on, when the job numbers come out, monthly job numbers, and suddenly Republicans are saying it's a miracle, I have to kind of remind them, actually, those job numbers are the same as they were in 2015 and 2016. And anyway, I digress. So we made progress, but, and this is the truth, my administration couldn't reverse 40-year trends in only 8 years, especially once Republicans took over the House of Representatives in 2010 and decided to block everything we did. Even things they used to support. So we pulled the economy out of crisis, but to this day, too many people who once felt solidly middle class still feel very real and very personal economic insecurity. Even though we took out bin Laden and wound down the wars in Iraq and our combat role in Afghanistan and got Iran to halt its nuclear program, the world's still full of threats and disorder that comes streaming through people's televisions every single day. And these challenges get people worried, and it frays our civic trust. And it makes a lot of people feel like the fix is in, and the game is rigged, and nobody's looking out for them, especially those communities outside our big urban centers. And even though your generation is the most diverse in history, with a greater acceptance and celebration of our differences than ever before, Those are the kinds of conditions that are ripe for exploitation by politicians who have no compunction and no shame about tapping into America's dark history of racial and ethnic and religious division. Appealing to tribe, appealing to fear, pitting one group against another, telling people that order and security will be restored if it weren't for those who don't look like us or don't sound like us or don't pray like we do. That's an old playbook. It's as old as time. And in a healthy democracy, it doesn't work.
President Obama, former President Obama, last Friday in Illinois giving a speech. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment about this program on extension 115. We'll play those comments back later on this week. And coming up in the next hour, Sean Canan is going to discuss the Upper Tampa Bay Trail, whether or not it's threatened by development. And you're going to find out about a concert to bring attention to gun violence and the importance of youth voters. That's coming up in the next hour. Thanks for listening. This is WMNF in Tampa. Frank Knox has been our phone producer today. I'm Rob Lurie. Here's the latest news from NPR.